philosophers in space, 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 space.
I knew it! Insane theories one, regular theories a billion.
I was God once.
Yes, I saw. You were doing well until everyone died.
I feel like I'm all alone.
You are all alone. I'm a holographic projection.
Well, he's got all the money in the world, but there's one thing he can't buy.
What's that?
A dinosaur.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 186. The Foreigners, part 2. Yeah.
City hall.
In the heart of the city.
To the county
that's
line.
It's a fantastic theme song.
It's so good, right? Is it hooked in deep now?
Oh, yeah. I love this.
You can feel it, right? It's got those deep, deep hooks. It's so good.
It's a great theme song.
I've literally been singing it since we last finished recording. It's just been nonstop loop. That's how it works.
Yep. So hopefully you have watched everybody the show Foreigners because it's great, and hopefully you've watched at least through season one, episode 3, because that's what we intend on covering today. And you know, it's not the most spoilery show that would matter that much. Like, you'd still easily listen to this and then watch it. It's not really that big of a deal because it's a great show, and it's about the immersion. It's about the process. You know, it's about storytelling. Mm-hmm. I don't have any other tie-ins besides you sing the theme song.
Yeah, so. No, I was just gonna say this one is definitely, I've been seeing a lot of people responding, really enjoying the show and basically being like, I would never have found this otherwise. And it really is like, this episode in particular had the feel of, you know, you're out hunting and you've been hunting for like a week in like the deep woods of HBO and there's just, it's just nothing.
Yeah.
And you're like about to give up. And then you see
it. The show is the disgusting, bloody, raw rabbit meat that you finally.
Yeah. No, it's like a gigafauna tree sloth that you just like happened to kill. And like everyone around gets to feast for like a week.
It's, oh, good call. Yeah. No, it's better than disgusting rabbit meat. Okay, side note. That's in this episode. All right, we should go in the exposition zone here. So
there was one other thing before you bop it, which was we were discussing, because we were trying to find summaries of this show just to double check, you know, what happens in what episodes to make sure we don't spoil anything. And there's nothing. And we're really, I think at this point, genuinely convinced that this is an anti-meme and that like maybe we're the only people who can see it. Maybe none of y'all can see this show. Maybe you're the only people who can see it too. Maybe it's like once somebody tells you about it, you can see it. But for some reason, it does not appear to exist outside of that. So good luck.
Not enough people are watching this show. Somebody watch it and do write-ups of the episodes for us. There's a little bit on the Wikipedia, but it's, you know, it's a little sparse. It's not not enough.
And include name pronunciation guides.
El Fildur. All right, let's get to the exposition zone. Why don't we bop it?
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
What is Norge for bop it? Bop it.
Bop it, it's in sun, Charvin sun. <I don't... laughs> Paparazzi and Ritz and Son. All right. So, are we trying to cover episode 2 and 3 or just 3?
We're going to briefly cover a little bit of 2 and mostly focus on 3. But we can, you know, we can expand out our world building here a little bit, talk about Navin and, you know, the different types of peoples.
Yeah, when we last left our show, by the way, I forgot, we haven't gotten to talk about this. I did finally correct my grievous error of watching with the dubs and watched with the subtitles. And boy, it's way different. thing, like, mm-hmm. it's like language is different. It's not as though they just read the same source, whatever it is, you know, like mm-hmm. the English dubs and the English subtitles are different. They're written by different people, apparently, because they're different. So that was cool. Yeah. And it was cool to get some like different little nuances out of that. And when I was able to actually pay more attention visually to the show, I discovered some more things that I hadn't. It's great. It's worth watching twice, actually.
you caught on to some of the subtle messaging and symbolism of that first episode.
So when we last left our heroes, there's the, you know, they're still trying to figure out where this victim, you know, how she died. She seems to be from the past and seems to have died from a net. There's the whole sea monster thing. And then at the beginning of this episode, I think is when our main guy, whose name I don't know. I know Al Fielder's
Lars.
Name. His name Lars. Sure, it might be Lars, or you're a racist. Either way, you might just be saying Lars.
You'll never know because you can't find the show.
Yeah, his name is definitely an anti-meme. I couldn't possibly tell you what it is.
It's whatever I say it is.
So he realizes that the sea monster, based on that illustration that the guy, the police sketch artist did, is actually the fishing net, which is something I figured out having actually paid attention to the first episode the second time. I was like, oh, that's what that is.
Put it in the pieces together. Yeah.
It's like, that was obvious in retrospect when you're just, you know, not fully engaged. And so they take this discovery to kind of follow the trail of, you know, who mm-hmm. this victim is. And it leads them to different places. It leads them to Cro-Magnon Security, which I love, which is like this, you know, I guess Stone Age employee, you know, kind of security firm, which is great.
And they find it by accident. I don't know if you remember this part, because I know you've watched a little beyond now at this point, but this is the situation where Al Fielder,
she's out.
She gets her friend, the shield maiden Ingrid, out of trouble for having defaced a false picture.
Oh, that's a great little moment. Yeah, I love
so
that.
Funny. Yeah, yeah.
So and they, good call. Yeah. So we should talk about that because it's funny. Yeah, her friend, so who I don't think we had we met up until now, or is this our introduction?
No, this is her introduction, yeah. And I love her so much. This is the perfect introduction.
Yeah, we find out she's in trouble because mm-hmm. she has defaced a painting in a museum, basically like just punched a hole in it, I think. And, mm-hmm. you know, Al Fielder being a cop is going to go help her out. And the way the people in the museum are like, this is so much money, like she's in big trouble, we're going to sue for all this kind of thing. And then Al Fielder pulls this like, well, wait, do you have essentially like trigger warnings about how this artwork from she was in this war? Like you're essentially
written in the different languages in Viking.
Right. Like, written all the different. So it's like in a kind of you know, I guess I don't know what their law is there, but for us, it would be some sort of like, right. you know, I don't know what law it would come under, but it's this sort of civil rightsy type argument.
Yeah, it's like a wokeness trolling joke a little bit here.
Slash like accessibility a little bit, you know, like, do you not have you don't have a ramp or something? It's like that kind of thing. And it enables her to get her friend off scot-free, which I think is really funny. And so mm-hmm. that's how at that point when they're kind of, you know, I think is it when they're partying after that? I think it is.
Yeah, right? They go party and she slips through mushrooms.
Yeah. And then that's when she happens to see, Al Fielder happens to see that Cro-Magnon thing. I actually still don't know how she puts two and two together. Is it just that she sees they have a net? Is that what it was?
I think it's just she sees women coming out of it or something like that. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, but something. Yeah. And then she does some research that tells her that they have purchased the fishing net. And she's mm-hmm. like, why does a security firm need a fishing net? Probably don't need to go on this.
Or something like that. Yeah. Right. A little too much detail,
but whatever. That's how she gets to that security firm. They further trace that. Now, is that where we start meeting Navin?
Right. So we get Navin first, and then they connect it all together. Mm, and we get this that great scene with Navin where it starts out with him hunting a rabbit. And we haven't had any, like, Cro-Magnon characters yet, right?
Yeah, exactly. This is kind of our first actual focused look at a Stone Age character. And it starts with, mm-hmm. as you say, a hunting sequence of the rabbit and all that. And then he like comes upon, it's great introduction. He comes upon, it makes it look like he's stumbled on some wealthy house and some, you know, suburban mm-hmm. type or I guess like wealthier type woman unloading groceries. And he's like going to attack her. But then it turns out he was just playing a joke and he's married to her. And they're the most fun couple of this Amazing. Show. I love it so much. It gets really funny. And so that's when we find out he's a Stone Age man who has, I guess you would say, successfully assimilated into this society to the point where we come to find out he's kind of the leader of this human trafficking ring.
Yeah, it's an interesting example of a, like, not quite assimilated. We might think of him almost like, you know, a mobster, like a minority mobster who sort of maintains a reputable business front, like, you know, what's his name in Good Wife or something like that, right? Or in The Wire. And so he has this wife who's like an influencer and like does, you know, they do a whole like lifestyle brand around him being, you know, Stone Age and her being in the present. But like behind all of it, he still is like an unintegrated, like incredibly dangerous killer who, you know, has taken over some amount of the like illegal, you know, human trafficking and other kinds of stuff in the society. So I like that as a version of, you know, the pretending to be integrated while not actually being sort of character.
Wow. I guess I don't know. Pretending. How is he pretending to be?
Because he acts like he's civilized when he needs to be, but he's still, you know,
hold on. When do we get a single shot of him acting like being civilized? He's just hanging out naked all the time.
I mean, there's the party where he puts like clothes ish
sort of a robot kind of.
Yeah, he's kind of like a, you know, he's like a mobstery kind of character, and I like that it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, he's also coming from this very marginalized background in theory. If we're, you know, carrying out the metaphor here, he's like, he's been highly successful, but he's partly been highly successful because he like is exploiting his own people through human trafficking.
Right. Yeah. But I guess I'm sorry to quibble, but I don't think he's like, I don't think he's, I guess I shouldn't have said he's assimilating because really he's very insistently just keeping his own customs.
Right. He sort of will pretend to the least degree necessary. And it's interesting that he sort of is rewarded for doing that in this society.
Yeah, because so all the shots we get of him are basically him just hanging around. It's time that we talk about the male nudity in this show. Finally.
I mean, finally. We can't fully talk about it during the main show, but let's say, you know, some wrongs have been righted, let's say, right? Like
some rods.
Some scales have been balanced, right?
Oh boy. It's a lot. It's great. But it totally works. He is keeping his, and that's why I kind of emphasized the quibbling there. I shouldn't have said assimilated because he's not really assimilated. He's just he's profiting in this world. Like he's, I don't know what the word for that would be, but he's found a way to be highly successful in this world while basically rigidly sticking to his customs. You know, he's still hunting rabbit. And this is where I have to ask you, even Stone Age people don't just eat raw rabbit meat, right?
Does he cook it a little bit even or something?
No, he just grabs the rabbit and takes bites out of it. Like it's juicy, bloody, gross. Nonsense.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, that doesn't.
I'm not a scientist, to be honest.
I feel like the invention of applying heat to food, I feel like is very, 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 very old.
Yeah. to be clear, though, this guy succeeding as a violent mobster and also like public influencer is completely plausible to me in our society, like in a modern world where, you know, he would be like a guru for, you know, guys who want to get back to, you know, like think about the paleo folks. How many paleo folks would lose their minds over someone like this talking about what he actually does all day? And like, you know, he would probably obviously want to do it as little as possible, but like it would be such a easy kind of payoff and structure for someone like that to adapt into that setting. And also somebody actually corrected us and I can drop this in here, which is I think I called it a socialist country in the first episode, and they were pointing out that like technically it's not really a socialist country, it's like a capitalist country with a robust safety net. And again, there's all sorts of issues around the languages there, but I think it is a good point to highlight that like countries like this can often look idyllic compared to America's dystopia collapsing empire situation. But like they are still exploitative systems that, succeed in benefiting the, like, as we talked about last time, benefiting the people within their own communities by not, you know, letting people in to take advantage of those resources and safety nets. And so, like, in that, within that system, right, where you are still in a kind of capitalist model, someone who's cutthroat in this kind of way, you would imagine would generally do pretty well. And I was actually, I was a little unhappy with how this character's arc fully worked out, given how good I thought the start was.
Yeah. I also want to, again, sorry for the quibbling, but I feel like he's not an influencer. It's entirely his wife is taking advantage.
They don't show it. They don't show it in the thing. But what I was saying is, like, it's very reasonable to me that, like, off camera they could be doing interviews and stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I got the impression that it was more just like she's just capitalizing on his image and stuff like that and his whatever. But yeah, well, either way. So he's a great character. He seems to be in charge of this criminal operation, and when he senses that, based on, you know, seeing that I think somehow he gets the sense that the heat's on, you know, to his criminal operation. I don't remember exactly how, but
I don't think it's a tip off from somebody in the police, maybe, or something like that. Yeah, something like that. I don't remember either how that works.
And he's like, all right, you know, close it off. We need to get rid of all the, you know, trafficked women from this brothel temporarily, like, just, you know, hide them for now. Like, don't risk getting caught at all. And the person that he's dealing with, the brothel owner, who I think now the other guy isn't foppish. That was an incorrect word for it. But this guy, I think you could call him foppish, right?
Have we defined these terms yet?
Actually, I don't know. But
between episodes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Go ahead. But this guy for sure is more that.
A proper fop, right?
A proper fop. And he doesn't want to. There's a lot of, you know, obviously, like, taking these girls off the market is going to cost him money, So there's some conflict over that. And I think it's interesting that you have you're playing against type a little bit, where the Stone Age guy is, like, being super cautious in terms of, getting in trouble in this business. And then the 19th century guy, who you would think would be, like, the more sophisticated crime person, is like, nah, screw it. Like, we just keep him in there, whatever, you know.
Got money to make.
Yeah, they play against – it's fun. They play against that type a lot. Like, they like to emphasize how actually sophisticated the Stone Age guy is, Navin, is in his thinking, which I think is fun.
But I also like the scene where the guy, the foppish guy, tries to, like, threaten him with, you know, whatever people he works for or something like that. And I'm just like, I'm just going to rip your throat out. Like, I'm just that kind of person.
Right.
And the wife sort of stops him. But yeah, really, I love the dynamics between the different temporal communities, essentially.
Yep. So, he doesn't kill the guy by ripping his throat out, but he almost does. And then so that's that part. And then we get to I think that's when it kind of switches to the Tori Hunt story a little bit.
Or am I missing something? Yeah, right. Else? We get these other, like, the character that Alfilder and Ingrid are interested in. And we sort of get it pieced out to us a little bit, right?
Are they interested in it? Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was trying to say they were with him or if they were just they fought alongside him. I couldn't tell.
We get some flashbacks to, like, Alfilder in the past, and, like, she's tracking Tor. And she finds out that Ingrid is also tracking him. And so I think the implication is they've like, continue to be looking for him in the present to some extent. But, like, he doesn't seem to remember who he is initially. We get the impression, like, we get introduced to him in a great example of, like, the way that a lot of these characters would have to deal with, like, a lot of degrading, like, subjection that they wouldn't deal with before, subjugation or whatever you want to put it. Like, he's like running delivery service of, like, high-end sushi and stuff.
Well, that's how he's discovered is really funny. Mm-hmm. He's on a bike. He's a bike delivery guy with food, and he's, like, hit by a car or something, or some accident hits a person, some accident
almost,
like,
hits
that.
A stroller. Yeah.
Oh, right. That's what it is. Yeah. And then somebody else who also knows him, some dude, sees it's him and is like, Tori Hunt, but he doesn't have his memory. So this is, like, the great Tori Hunt, you know, the hero to that, to Elfielder and the other girl. And he has no memory of who he was, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's right. a lot of comedy of him being this like really settled down, kind of domesticated, like the opposite of what he would have been back in the day.
Right. And we see that sort of play out. And I guess we can sort of just wrap that up and then focus on what we really want to talk about here, yeah. which is the beginning of episode three. So like at the end of episode three, we get like Tor again trying to resist being pulled back into remembering all this stuff. Like you get the sense that he's getting like maybe flashes a little bit, but like he's been resisting it or something. And then he gets sort of jumped by some I think we know that they're Christians in particular, right? Do they make that explicit there? I don't quite remember. But we start to get the sense that there's like a Christian Viking fight going on. And I think these guys are specifically jumping him for that reason, or they're just trying to like...
Right. Oh, when his old... Rob him. Right, when his old enemies kind of track him down. Yeah.
Right.
I think enemy, it's revenge because right, yeah. he killed... There's somebody right, okay. that he killed that's like
It's like Olaf the Stout or something yeah, like that,
Olaf
maybe.
The Stout. Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, so they track him down and he remembers in the midst of like... beating them all up in a parking garage. So
well, that's
in a,
the
like,
end of episode
yeah.
three, right? So did we
right,
skip?
Well, not quite the exact end. Yeah, well, I figured we'd go back around and talk about okay, the thing that sure. like in episode three should be like the center of our attention
gotcha.
Here. I guess we should also maybe mention just the end of Navin's story too, and then we can talk about the transtemporalism. Because like at the very end of episode three, they have Navin back out in the woods like he was at the beginning of episode two, and he gets just straight up murdered by a drone.
Yeah.
And I was unhappy with that, to be honest. Same. I really wanted him to be around longer and do more things.
Yeah.
I thought he was such a great, he was so well acted too, and like the facial stuff was all so good looking. Like
maybe
just,
they were like, if we keep him around forever, that's like infinite dong that's going to be in the show.
All the dong budget. We've just,
so
we've
much dong. Yeah.
All the dong budget.
The Even they have their dong limits, I think. They're like, we can't, yeah. we're just mapping this out. His character is committed to full dong out almost all the time.
They're going to have to start doing like dong James budget. Bond hiding his dong through various kinds of effects and things.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're going to leave the dong talk for After Dark. That's
we will.
Clearly
we will.
A separate topic.
I mean, the in-depth yeah. dong talk. This is just a yeah. surface.
But also, I think a really fascinating like sci-fi, you know, moment to have this Stone Age hunter get murked by a super advanced drone. Right. Right.
Yeah, like, he has no idea what it is. Right. He just kind of looks up at it like, oh, what's that? And then just wastes him. Yeah.
Just total contrast. And the idea of him like hitting the rabbits with the rock versus that thing murdering him is, I think, just a beautiful juxtaposition there.
Yeah, I feel like this show, this is another thing that doesn't need any of our time, but this show overestimates what can be done with small rocks in terms of hunting.
There's a lot of highly opinion? Successful rock
way
chucking.
Too highly yep. successful rock throwing.
Yeah, extremely successful rock chucking. You're not wrong. Just like straight up rock. Like not even like they use a fancy rock chucking.
No.
You know,
they have Alfielder throw a rock 300 feet.
3 million
And hit
yards,
a person.
Yes.
And that's just like, all right. Not
and
everybody
not
in the
him,
past
just, like,
was a superhero. Yeah. Like the accuracy of throw. Like we have people who are very good at throwing in this day and age. And I don't think they could do that.
It's kind of a Bravehearty like throwback joke there. I feel like the rock throwing stuff in Braveheart. Okay, so now we can talk about the most important thing, which is the transtemporalism.
So
community.
We get a bit of a reveal that the previous autopsy was not done quite thoroughly enough of the victim, and the new
because
autopsy
racism.
They reveal. That due to, I love it. The clue was it like she has a Lego in her stomach? There's something
she's
like that.
Lego, yeah, stuck yeah. in her body.
Yeah, and she's like, and the doctor's like, or the whatever, the guy, coroner, he's like, we discovered this in her stomach. She must have swallowed it when she was small. It's like a Lego. It's like, okay, that couldn't have happened if she's from the past. So it turns out she's not from the past. She's actually possibly, as far as we know at this point, she might be part of the transtemporal community. And this is also another very plausible thing that I love about the show, that it's a group of people, well, who knows how many it is or whatever, but we focus on like one kind of gathering of them, one collection of them at this, whatever you call it, transtemporal, like, I don't know, village type thing. And they want to pretend to be from different times. They identify as being from different times. And she's possibly from that. And so they go visit that community to try to track down who she might be.
Yeah, and I love this transtemporal community because, you know, we'll talk about it in the philosophy about what is this trying to say about these kinds of issues, but just for a second, enjoy the way that, like, such a well set up world and concept gets executed so beautifully in terms of content where, you know, they open with them doing a, like, sharing circle where the people are talking about their experience sort of coming out as transtemporal. Yeah. And like what, you know, like explaining how when they were young they didn't want to play with the kind of modern stuff like the other kids.
Right.
They like, you know, they liked the old timey things, and really it was that they should have actually been from that time. I mean, when you think about how many people, and it's like, it's a really interesting idea when you think about the natural inclination towards nostalgia in human beings. If this became kind of a acceptable identity, you know, you've got the Amish already, but like how many other people would adopt version of this, right? Like how far is this from hipsterism or like steampunk cosplay? Like,
yeah, I mean, you touched on it earlier with Navin, like this, we already kind of have this. It's just not as structured because of, you know, I think having the act community of people actually from that time in the in their present kind of gives it a little more, I guess, structure, or gives it a little something to bounce off of. But yeah, we, you know, there's all the kind of Joe Rogan-esque, like eating the paleo, like raw meat, whatever, like whatever they would have had back then. Then there's also like what I would think of as a little bit more of a benign kind of version of it, which is just like old timey man type stuff, like people really are attracted to. And like, honestly, I get with the more we get to experience the stepdad character, the 1900 stepdad, he's just best.
The best. Yeah.
And it's the more I understand it, I'm like, I can't help it. That's awesome. I kind of
want to save that because that's mostly after episode 3. So I don't want to talk too much about any of it. But yes, he's my favorite sleeper character in the show.
Love him so much. Yeah. And so we already do kind of have this to some extent, but it's interesting to put more of a formalized kind of structure to it.
Yeah, I wanted to point that out as well, which is that, like, the reason I highlighted in the previous episode the fact that the mother is kind of wearing the old-timey clothing is that they're seeding this for us, right? And now you go back and you realize, wait, is she a transtemporal? Was she...
Right, maybe. Like,
what's the difference between... Or is she just kind of...
Yeah.
Or, yeah, like, and what's the difference between actually adopting, you know, actually going all the way and saying, I'm from that time versus... You know, I just prefer wearing this more old-timey clothing.
Right,
and, like,
you
get bits where, you know, he's, like, almost training her, I guess, in, like, the older ways of thinking at various moments. So it's sort of what, you know, all the different layers, I think, come together really
beautifully. It's sad that we're not covering the next episode because that really does come together
episode. Yeah, I mean, I think we can come back to this show again, too. Like, I don't think...
Yeah.
I mean, there's going to be another season, so I, like... I don't think there's anything wrong with dipping back in on this one again. Another thing that I wanted to mention in this this part where they first get the transtemporal community is they, when they're going in, they have to hand over all their cell phones. And it's not like just a respect thing. It's a little bit of like a, they say a thing about like some of the people are allergic
sensitive to electricity.
Sensitive to electricity, right. But you can just imagine like how many different like, people would crop up to just take advantage of people in this world, like in this kind of, in all of these spaces, right? It just, it's such a fecund space for people to sort of grow a bunch of different nonsense around people's genuine desire to like feel more connected to something. It ties so well into the like, a lot of the stuff people are talking about these days where it's, you know, modernism, technology taking us away from ourselves, our present and such. It is a really easy kind of escapism, you could imagine, to sort of adopt that cosplaying sort of personality.
Right. Oh, yeah. I wasn't sure if we were going to talk about this more in the philosophy section.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, for sure. We can.
And then we do get introduced to a character as one of the people who seems to be a transtemporal person, not totally sure at this point, steals their laptop and like hacks it. So you get the kind of the funny image of somebody dressed in 1800s garb, very sophisticatedly stealing and hacking into this laptop,
dodging their way around the little ghosts in order to break through the hacking system. Yeah.
Right.
I like that too. And I, I think of it also as like similar to Navin as the gangster leader. You also have this idea that like these people are also running kind of gangstery grifts on the side. And yeah, there are other characters who we'll see, you know, go even farther with that kind of stuff as well. Other than that, I think that's pretty much, and like, you know, we also get confirmed about stuff like there's a whole industry now of people who do body modifications to people to make them
appear
more like. So the reason that she was mistaken is not just that like they just assumed, but she had all of the like the tattoos
kind of bone
and
type stuff going on.
Had her fillings removed, for example. So like there's this kind of back to
medical transition.
Like, it's a sharp amount of layers on there, right?
Yeah, forgot about the good detail to add there.
All right, shall we
grok it and step into the philosophies that grok it.
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
So, yeah, obviously there's a lot here. I guess let's, you know, maybe take baby steps through all of this, right? So I think the first thing to ask is just a generic question like, is transtemporalism as portrayed in this episode, as far as we know, is it like, is it bad? Is it problematic? Is the show mocking it, do we think? Like, what are we even... What should our interpretation at this point even be about? What is this saying about these kinds of, behaviors, individuals, approaches, communities, etc.?
Oh, you're asking me?
Yeah. I'm curious what your sense of it is at this point.
Good art, I think, usually doesn't just cram answers down your throat. And I think it's doing a pretty good presentation of it as it plausibly might be, you know, which I think... Mm-hmm. So I don't think the show is putting like a heavy thumb on the scale, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. I haven't really thought of what the show's saying about it. I mean, it does have our main characters roll their eyes at the sensitive to electricity, allergic to electricity thing, which is, which is fair because that's kind of dumb. But like other than that, I don't feel like there's a ton of like heavy handedness about it in itself. I don't know. What do you think?
So when I first watched through it, I didn't read it as being like that. I read it as being sort of a really clever take on these kinds of issues that, like you said, isn't necessarily saying anything one way or another. I did, look around online some. Of course, there's nothing about this show, but if you dig deep enough, you can find a few other human beings.
So then you made a website.
Right, so that I invented a friend to talk to online and then get mad at, right, obviously. Yeah. But no, I did find people who were like, Foreigners... really takes the piss out of transgenderism, basically. Yeah. And it's why I wanted to mention that there was the other, like, the digs at wokeness, quote unquote, that I think I don't know if that necessarily totally translates over there, but it does, the using the exact right kind of terminology, the putting the signs up. There's a great bit about gluten in one of these episodes. It isn't like totally wokeness, but it's kind of like, making fun of modernism kind of stuff, essentially.
But I guess keeping what I would say in mind, there's also mixed in with that a healthy roasting of like the terrible, police captain guy and the way he's like trying to artificially take advantage of the diversity. So I feel like it's roasting everybody a little bit, which I think is good. It's kind of finding ways to poke at basically every side of this.
Yeah, and that's where I would end up as well. I just do think you could also, going off a textual argument, rather, you could make a case that like there is some sending up of the kind of coddly, like deferential kind of politics, right? Where you're just like overly deferential to people who are, asserting a certain kind of identity or something like that.
Importantly, I think it does poke fun, a particular detail about the police stuff, in the first episode, it does, I think, effectively satirize too much focus on identity, you know, because like there's the guy introduces her like, oh, we you know, here's our first multi-temporal background person. She's going to bring her, you know, insights from the dot. And she's like, I'm also a trained police officer. You know, like I also am just a like I passed the training. I am a police officer, you know. So it kind of I like that in that it roasted the over focus on identity to that can be an unhealthy, like on the liberal side, trying to way too much focus on like, oh, this person has all this unique knowledge. Like, yeah, also that you can treat them as a person within what they are, like they are a police officer. Like you don't have to worship
like the magical Viking kind of problem.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. And it is kind of, again, it's an, it can come out of a over deferential approach to, like we were talking about, you know, non-traditional ways of knowing or indigenous ways of knowing or something like that, whether we got with the sea monster stuff. So yeah, I do think it is, it's doing a good job of critiquing all these things. And I also think, yeah.
Yeah, another point there. I like that it didn't end up being a freaking sea monster. And it wasn't like, ah, see, the alternate ways of knowing are good. Which it could have. I actually was like, well, in this world of time travel, there could have been some ancient type animal that seems to us like a sea monster that just... So far, it's only humans for some reason, but there's no reason that it couldn't
that
be like
a monster couldn't come
a literal sea monster, what we would think is a sea monster, but it's just a really
that's
old
good.
Thing.
That's good. That that's a very clever point. I absolutely hadn't even thought of that.
They could have gone that way, but they didn't. Instead, they went with, it isn't so important that she thinks it's a sea monster, but it is important that she was actually listening to the to the witness. And what they were saying.
100%. I was just writing on the same thing. Like, you know, it's so crucial. The alternate ways of knowing stuff is not just you just take their word for it. It's more you actively listen to where they're coming from and like try to understand their perspective and why they have that perspective. And maybe there's valuable insights and just like also just treating them as a person and not as, you know, some defective individual who doesn't know what they're talking about.
Right. Automatically assuming you know better on everything or like you're right about everything and they have nothing to teach
and
you.
There's another version of that too that came up, which is we find out in her interactions with Ingrid, what may not have been fully explicit initially, but they have to hide what their jobs were when they were Vikings.
Oh, yeah.
Did
well,
you catch that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's apparently, and this I'm sure is setting up conflict for later that I haven't fully seen, but she said in her application that she was like, you know, farmer's wife. And then, and there's even a little, you get the impression from the joking that like, that's what everybody said. Like everyone from that time was like, yeah, farmer's wife, whatever. Like, that's what you just say you are. And for for some reason, if you were some type of warrior, you wouldn't have been allowed on the force, which is interesting.
I think this actually makes really good sense in a like clever satirical kind of way. Right. So, you know, we have this like idea, well, oh, we would want the warrior class people to take up the warrior class position in our society. But if you think about, at least in principle, that like these are supposed to be peacekeepers, not Vikings.
Yeah.
Right.
True.
You don't want bloodthirsty, you know.
Right. As an American, perhaps that's why it was hard to understand.
Less clear to you. Yeah. Right. Because you're confused.
Other
about
countries don't want just hardcore killers as their police officers.
They're not going for the militarized
seasoned
police
murderers is not what they want in their police. Okay. Gotcha.
But
weird.
It's also a really
you're
great
doing
example.
It wrong.
Right. It's also a really great example, though, of like the way that individuals in marginalized communities who've had to do things like be in the military or stuff like that, where they
or have some like, you know, minor criminal record
or have
kind
a minor criminal
thing.
Background, so they're treated as being intrinsically dangerous and unreformable, essentially, right? Like the idea is if you were honest about that background, nobody would ever fully trust you. And even we even see they don't fully trust her with like weapons already, right? There's kind of a vibe of, you know, is this lady going to just start murdering everybody at some point? So I like that because it, you know,
well,
you get
it,
the sense of...
Again, quibbling. Not that she would murder everybody, but I got the sense that it was like, oh, you know, ignorant person from another time doesn't understand how this, you know, machinery works kind of thing.
That too. But also I get the sense of like, she almost has to kind of do the like quiet, like marginalized lady, where if she were like more loud and aggressive, people would be too scared of her, like an angry black lady, which brings up another good criticism that somebody raised about this show, which I think is fair. And they actually compared it to like the Marvel stuff. I think it was actually General Contact Unit Problem Child brought this up in the Patreon, that the transtemporal thing, especially by not having people of color from the past where there might have been, like, you know, people of color, this show manages to make it about marginalized experiences while having an all-white cast or almost all-white cast, which is, I think, a fair critique, that it's like you're getting the, you know, the ideas of marginalization, but it's still white people and other white people.
True.
Yeah. So just something to think about there.
I don't know much about Norway, but it's a pretty white place, I imagine.
But I think probably the argument they made was that, like, the Stone Age people would not be white.
Yeah, totally.
So there could be something like that,
right,
for example.
Yeah.
Right. I think we can agree
that. But I wasn't justifying the decision. I was saying that's why they're making that. It's a super white place. That might be why they have this blind spot, is what I was saying.
Yes. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. That's also very plausible, right? So what is, you know, like, let's talk about what does this actually raise in terms of questions around sort of identity transition, broadly speaking, right? So obviously there's the, like, initial level of this, well, not obviously, but like there's the initial level of this, which we talked a little bit about before, which is the, like, transgender versus transracial, right? And oftentimes in the mix of criticizing transgender, people will point to transracial and say you have to allow this too, and they'll sort of do a kind of slippery slope where they'll actually talk about things like transtemporal, like, what if I identify as being 20 instead of 40 or something? You know, on one level, this show still kind of a little plays into, like, the concrete assumptions. And I found a good article related to this stuff. Didn't actually talk about this episode, this show, because it doesn't know it exists. But it was sort of pointing to one problem in the way we talk about these questions, which is we kind of implicitly assume the first thing we have to do is figure out whether this person really is what they say they are, right? And so we have to figure out the criteria for being a woman or for being black or for being, you know, from a different time period or something like that, right? And then once we found out that criteria, we check if they meet that criteria and then we award them the status of, you know, whatever kind of person they are or something, right? Mm-hmm. And what this article was criticizing about that was it misunderstands the nature of things like woman or race or, you know, we maybe not temporal, and that might make it a problem for the kind of analogy here. But basically the idea was there is no set exact criteria for what it means to be a woman. There's no set exact criteria, like essential features, essentially, for what it is to be of a particular race. And so really it's always a question of, you know, what are the reasons for and against assigning this to a particular person? Do they cash out in a way that seems correct to us, essentially? And then we create rules socially around that. And so, you know, so, like, basically what we could say is if you just do a straight reading of the transtemporal community, you would have to argue that this is playing into people's mental illness in a sense, right? You'd have to take a kind of pathological, medicalized analysis and say, look, we know for a fact these people are not from the time that they think they're from, right? It's one thing to say, I want to adopt old-timey clothing and talk about old-timey stuff. But if you're really saying, I actually think I'm from that time, which is what we see some of in those communities, right? Then it's like, how is this different from, you know, I'm saying I'm Napoleon or something? Literally, how are you, like, you know, somebody could come from the past and say, I'm Napoleon. And so then the question is, should we think of it that way? Like, should we see this as something that is, you know, like maybe just gender dysphoria, where we're treating mental illness, but like it's not actually really what they are. We're just trying to, like, ameliorate their symptoms, even if we can't change their essential nature. We don't believe that now when it comes to trans individuals, right? We think that, like, you can be trans without, like you, essentially you can transition and you don't have to abandon some particular essential feature in order to do so. We take sort of a mixed version of lived self-identification essentially as being like acceptable. And I think what this article was arguing for is that that's not like abandoning reality in any kind of way. It's actually recognizing that being a man or a woman has more to do with just, you know, particular features of when you were born. It has to do with the way that you experience your identity and interact with society in various ways. And so it's not like, and so this gets complicated, right? Because some people might want to say, well, I was always a woman and now I actually, you know, it matches it in this kind of way. And then you could mean that in a non-essential kind of way, or you could potentially mean it in an essentialist like, and I think what you see from gender critical communities is they read it as an essentialist claim, right? Like what they'll say is that person's claiming they had a gendered soul that was always in their body and their body now matches their gendered soul. When I think what we actually understand them to mean is, you know, there is no true status of womanhood, but they have always felt, you know, a strong identity connected in that direction to various kinds of things, which for them identify with womanness or maleness. And so we, you know, identify that for them because there's not a cost to society to do so, essentially. Does that make sense? That was a lot of rambling. I apologize.
Yeah, that was I guess. I don't, yeah, I'm not sure. I think that this paper, it sounds right to me, but I'm trying to apply this onto transtemporalism and I'm not sure. I understand how it would be applied there, I guess, is the thing I'm missing.
So I think the way we could try to apply it there and talk about, if we wanted to try to make a case that there was still something wrong with transtemporalism that isn't just medicalizing it, then we could come back to the transracialism stuff. So the same article argues, even though there is no such thing as the essential features for being black, for example, they talk about that because they specifically, you know, Rachel Dolezal gets brought up frequently, yeah, and specifically at that time when this was being written. And what they basically say is, look, it's not like you can go to her DNA or her skin color or something like that and determine if she's black. And this is where I think things actually, I don't think they have a totally worked out argument here. I think it's actually murky, right? But the argument, the one they make is this sort of potential harms for allowing this in a system where we have not resolved the kind of intergenerational injustices that minorities of color have faced. And they make a couple of moves here that I think you could push back on. So first of all, they say intergenerational harms like inability to accrue wealth are transfer generationally amongst racial groups in a way that they're not amongst women. And so it's different to be transgender versus transracial. I would have to look at some data, but I'm a little skeptical initially of that idea, that I do think there's probably something to the idea that women in general have a harder time maintaining and accruing wealth because of a history of men dominating the public sphere and stuff like that. So I'd be curious to look at that. But basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to carve out an argument where they say, even though we acknowledge that women are a marginalized group and black people are a marginalized group, allowing for transgender individuals or recognizing transgender individuals doesn't have a harm in the way that recognizing transracial might, because of the different kinds of histories of oppression between them. And I'm not sure you can totally make that argument, actually. And like they also talk about, like, if you allow people to just sort of change over, then people can, you know, accrue a bunch of privilege and wealth and then switch over for fun or, you know, for other advantages or whatever they want. And that undermines the capacity for genuine reconciliation.
Yeah, I mean, as if that's the main thing undermining genuine reconciliation. But yeah, I guess I didn't realize we were going to be touching on one of the most difficult, thorny issues in current society, which is trying to differentiate between being trans in terms of gender and being trans in terms of race. It is interesting problem to try to think about. I don't know that
when I bring a large kill back to the community, yeah. It's going to involve some thorns. You know, there's going to be some thorns.
Yeah, because there is something really interesting. Because obviously, there's a lot of it that matters in how society has seen you. Mm-hmm. You know, because like I would imagine, and I think there are real examples of this, and I think there are real examples of this I've read about and have forgotten. But I would imagine if there were somebody who we all think is black, like they just look black, but actually isn't, but has faced all of the same racism, you know, a lot of the same, whatever, like the disparate treatment is persecuted against because of their, whatever. Like, I would imagine if that person was like, yeah, well, I'm basically black, even though genetically, I guess I'm not, but like, I am treated as black. I don't think we would have a huge problem with being like, yeah, I mean, you're black. Like, you're getting treated by society as that, you know?
And that's the whole, I mean, that is basically an accepted principle at this point, that there is no such thing as genetically black. That, like, there's no line you can draw around a community that tracks the racial groups, which is why biologists use populations and stuff instead of, like, the races. But this, you know, this brings up the real problem, which is, you know, whether you're black depends on what it means to be treated as a black person by society at a given point in time. And there's, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but there's, when I teach about like critical race theory in my indoctrination classes, you know, we talk about the history of racial laws in America, where you have these really absurd juxtapositions of rulings where, like, one year, this guy who looks really white can't get a ruling that he's actually white because he's actually Japanese and has a Japanese name, even though a person on the street would think he was white, essentially. And they rule that, like, he doesn't have the right biology, essentially. He doesn't come from the right stock. And then, like, 2 years later, there's another ruling where an Indian guy who claims to be Aryan because he's of Aryan stock, essentially, and so deserves to be treated as white biologically, is denied the same status. And the argument given is because he wouldn't be treated by as such by a person on the street because it doesn't look white. So,
yeah, courts have not arrived at the right answers on this, and historically, especially.
But it really highlights the point that, like, throughout history, these have always been arbitrarily drawn circles around, you know, marginalized communities, essentially.
And circles drawn by people trying, taking advantage of those communities, and drawn, circles drawn for their purposes and not for any, like, consistent logical principles.
Right. Eventually, we're going to do Man in a High Castle. And when we do, there's a great line in it about how Jews don't get to decide when they're white. That it's always, you know, whether or not it's time to kill a bunch of Jews determines whether or not they are actually white. So what do we end up with there then? Like, I lean towards a position of I'm for transgender. I think that affirming those identities is good and healthy and productive in our society 100%. And I think if we can't make a clean distinction between them, then I'm for transracial as well. Like, I think there's not a substantial social cost to offset trying to police this sort of thing. I do think we have a strong obligation to create societies where both of those things are acceptable, right? We have to get to the culture level society where people can just jump around to whatever identity they want and there's no oppression. So, like, it's not poverty tourism or something like that, right? It's not in any way ethically questionable. But, like, we should be, I guess, trying to move in that direction as continues to be my position, at least.
Yeah. No, I think we did talk about this for one of the other things. And
we talked a little bit about, yeah.
And I did like your kind of top line on that one, which was, you know, if we could get to a society where these problems are fixed, which might be impossible, but, like, if we could, then any of this stuff would be like, you know, choosing your build in a video game. Like, no one would really care that much. Like, I go with this kind of build, a character build, and you go with that one, and it wouldn't matter so much. We're not there. But I do still think, like, logically speaking, it is difficult to perfectly. I think there are problems with all the arguments I've heard thus far for why these two things should be distinct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is kind of tough. I don't know that I have the answers for it. You know, like what's interesting about the transracialism stuff too is some of the arguments about, like, the first go-to thing that I think of if someone were identifying as a race they're not is like, you're not that culture. That's not. And then I realize, like, a lot of that same logic, if I used it in a different context, would be really, like, horrible. It'd be like,
right,
you know, like, that would be reason for keeping your country racially pure and, like, get out of here because you're not our thing. Like, so I don't, right. I don't know. It's a little unsettling either way. And mm-hmm. I guess I don't know that I've heard an argument for this that makes perfect sense either way. And I don't know. I'm just kind of, like, agnostic on the whole thing.
And you also see, on the flip side, the policing within the cultures of, like, oh, you're not black enough,
yeah.
right? You haven't experienced enough of this to really count. So, like, everybody's kind of jostling over these identities all the time. Now, another way we could try to cut at this would, instead of trying to figure out categorically, is this thing good or bad, right? I think what we could say overall is that, like, we can affirm it, and we want to think about distinguishing between maybe genuine cases versus, like, problematic cases in some kind of way where, and this is hard because, again, what I was just saying there, I do stick to the idea that, like, it can't just be there's an external test or something necessarily. Yeah. It's more like, and
you're going to run into a lot of problems.
Right. But, like, if you think of examples of, like, someone sort of, like, nakedly exploiting one of these kinds of things for some reason, right? If we really come up with, like, just a cartoonishly,
yeah, like, let's say, for example, I think California may have passed a reparations bill. Mm-hmm. Let's say somebody decides to try to, like, take advantage of that, even though I think it's tied to actual ancestry and stuff. But, but like, let's say that could be an example. Like, someone's trying to take advantage of that and they just pretend.
Right. And I think we have to acknowledge that, like, so I guess I think what we would say is, if we really know that person is doing that, then we, you know, aren't under any obligation to honor their trolling behavior. Just like when someone says they're an attack helicopter, we don't have to honor all identities equally or something like that. If it, like, if you're really explicitly doing it to troll or for money or something like that, then we don't have to treat it as honorable. But the other side of it, I think, would be, I see that as a version of, like, a kind of free rider problem, where at the end of the day, the cost to policing it is likely to outweigh the benefits, right? That, like, think of it like, you know, people trying to cheat on Medicare or Social Security or something like that, right? Where, you know, trying to enforce, trying to, or means testing, these different kinds of ways to try to make these systems more resistant to people sort of taking advantage of them often, like, cost more than they save, and like, they make us feel better in terms of fairness, but at the end of the day, it would probably just be better to just let people identify in these different ways. And if some people do it exploitatively, it's going to be a small enough amount, and we're gonna, you know, deal with the costs, you know, we'll like deal with it if they do it in a criminal kind of way. And if they don't really do it in, like, a criminal kind of way, it's just, like, weird, like, cultural appropriation-y kind of way, then you just sort of, you don't enjoy their
judge
content
them on a
or something.
Social level, yeah.
Right. Like, well, you don't hang out with them or something.
Here's where we're over time and thornier, sure, getting thornier.
I know, right?
Here's where I actually think the science might be important, because it turns out, like, there's a little bit of research into this that, like, trans people, there are corresponding parts of the brain that, like, do correspond to gender identity somewhat. My understanding of it is somewhat. And again, these aren't one-to-one things where we can, like, scan someone and be like, you're a girl. You know, it's not like that. But, like, there are correlations that medically are like, yeah, no, this makes sense. This is, like, people in the area of the brain that kind of associated with identity and gender. There's more similarities between, you know, trans women and cis women than trans women and cis men, kind of thing. Like, that's my understanding of some of the research. And whereas there, but, like, the pitfall of that, which I totally get, is you don't want to just, like, say this is only acceptable if it's a medical thing that's, you know, like, we want to be in a, build a society where it's like, we're not scrutinizing people's brains to make sure they're the thing, which I totally get. But in this instance, it might be something that it sheds a little light on it, because there isn't that same science for transtemporalism or, transracialism, you know, there. So, like, it's, I think there's a different there might be just a fundamentally different phenomenon going on there, but I don't know exactly, you know, I'm not an expert on it, so I don't know.
Well, there'd be, yeah, maybe we can talk about this more. Let's say this. We'll talk about it more after dark, because I have some thoughts about that as well. I think there's some interesting correlates that could sort of be pointed to that don't perfectly line up, but I think, yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, well, it's gonna eat into our dong talk a little bit, but
okay, I guess we'll save plenty of time.
I have a lot of dong thoughts.
Yeah, I'm sure we do.
I always do. That's just true all the time.
Yeah, get it out in the open. I know that. I have.
All right, well, let's go to After Dark, where we do two things. We talk about dong and like some of the most like
important hot button issues of our day that are tearing our society. I mean, let's be fair, dong is also tearing our society.
Yeah, it's not related. Yeah,
it's pretty important, actually. It's unnecessarily central, one might argue, despite not being visible all the time.
All right, so I want to thank you all for listening to the show, but we got to do the things we do every week, which is, first off, what are we doing next week? What's our preview for next show? Foreigners 3? No.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that you ask this, because it means that I have bad news that you're not going to be happy about, but I don't want to spoil it. So let's
Dune
say
we're 4.
No, we're talking about Severance. We're going to talk about Severance, and this is a show, I think it's on, is it on Apple TV or something?
Yep,
like
Apple
that. It's
TV.
On one of the non-HBO ones, which means that that's why people know about it and everyone's been really excited about it, is because it actually exists. So we're going to talk about Severance before everyone forgets about it. And that's going to be at least 2 episodes, it seems like, because there's a lot going on there. But for the first one, we'll just cover the first episode. We'll set up the world and the like very basic. I mean, by basic, I mean, you know, really creepy, weird, clever ethical question that starts off this whole storyline. Right. Yeah.
And then also, what are our top patrons making you say this week?
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you. But as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, thanks to our strong pretending that they are AIs because it makes them feel better patrons. Somebody has to, and no one else will. Big Easy Blasphemy, Mike Hudson, Not a Namer of Dragons. Can I get 4 deconstructed Cronenbergs with extra sauce, please? Dude, Corey Ebert, I Embrace the Void, Now Philosophers in Space, My Brain is Hurting. That Bastard, Neil Polzin. Jesse Urbanowitz and Brenda Goodman, Chad T, and What If We Kissed Under a Hand-Stitched Quilted Bedspread? that's a good deep cut for folks who are in the Philosophers in Space Facebook group. You should definitely come hang out. And all the thanks to our definitely, absolutely not a clone, even though he has a number in his name, which is generally a giveaway, Blorco number 5.
Love it, Blorco number 5. All right, well, we're heading off to After Dark for Dong Talk, and
Dong's
you should really
away.
Join us. Dong's Away. That's our new bop it for After Dark, I think.
No.
Dong's Away. Yeah, no, it's print it. That's it. And chisel that
I've
into
made a horrible
the,
error. Can I go back in time
chisel that into
now?
The granite of the show. It's where that's it. Dong's Away. So we'll be headed over there. Join us, or we'll see you next week.
Has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/0g. You can find us on Twitter at @0gphilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.